Well, thank you, Alessia, and everyone for having invited me to give this seminar. So I will talk about the symmetries of horizons. I will be more specific later on what kind of horizons I will refer to. Namely, I will talk not only about event horizon of black holes, but also cosmological horizon or other kind of apparent horizon, like such as a Windler horizon or the apparent horizon that appear, for instance, in a symmetric that describes accelerated black holes. So I will be clear about how general this analysis will be. And from the beginning, I will say that it will be actually more general than isolated horizons. But the reason why I prefer this title is because for isolated horizon, there will be some interesting properties. So I will not restrict myself to isolated horizons, but I will specifically say why these are important. So the idea is, let me start with, first of all, some references. This will be based on this series of papers I wrote with Logado Ne, Hernán González, Miguel Pino, and Andrea Pum, when we were together in Brussels a long time ago. So, and then also I find as a motivation, a series of papers that appear a little bit after our paper, but almost simultaneously by Perry, Strominger, and Hockey, in which basically what we discuss is, all us discuss, is the possibility of finding an infinite dimensional symmetry in the vicinity of the event horizons of black holes. In the case of HPS, Hawking, Perry, and Strominger, the symmetries were related, the look for the symmetries were related to the search for the symmetry was related to an attempt to solve the information paradox. So let me start by saying, to be clear from the beginning, that I will not make any statement about information problem or something like that. I will just focus on different applications of this emergence of infinite dimensional symmetries near the horizon of black holes. So this, I will mention different results, and these are, apart from these three papers, which in which I will mainly focus on, these are my collaborators with whom I have worked on that in the last 3 years. And also there are many, many other colleagues have been working on that. Some of them are here, like Celine and other people, on related stuff. When I say related stuff, I mean the quest for frameworks in which infinite dimensional symmetries emerge in the near horizon region of black holes. So let me start by saying something different, which is actually related to what I will say mathematically, but physically it's a different problem, which is the so-called BMS symmetry, with which many of you are familiarized, for sure more than me. So with this is a very old result from 1962, more precisely, which is the fact that asymptotically flat spacetime, and when I say asymptotically flat spacetime, of course you have to give a prescription to what it means asymptotically flat. I will be more precise in a second. A flat spacetime in the region of non-infinity, or if you want past infinity, so you know this region I describe last, where all the massless fields end up. So if you look at the isometries that preserve not the metric, not the flat metric, but the asymptotically flat sector of metrics, so what you find as a surprise is that the Poincaré symmetry, which would be the isometry, of course, of Minkowski, gets enhanced to an infinite dimensional symmetry, which is called the BMS symmetry, okay? So this is a result, as I said, very old, from 1962, and it was a surprise at the time. Of course, it's not the only scenario in which we have an enhancement symmetry that end up being an infinite dimensional symmetry. For instance, we have also the Geroh phenomenon, or even the ADS3 CFT2 example by Eno and Brown. So we have many examples in which indeed when you impose some boundary conditions, you find out that there is an enhancement of the isometry group to the asymptotical isometry group, which turns out to be in some cases infinite dimensional. So in the last years, notably by the group of Glenn Barnidge and collaborators, this asymptotic symmetry analysis was put on solid grounds in the sense that the solid computation of the of the of of the algebra of the algebra of charges associated to the symmetry have been computed, taking into account especially cocycles and central extensions. I will not go into details for BMS because I will take it just as a motivation, as an analogy of what I will do close to the horizon. So, but the idea is the following: in BMS, you look at the at asymptotically flat spacetimes at null infinity, and then you impose the following boundary conditions. So these are boundary conditions at sky plies. And then if you, instead of asking which is the transformation that did Minkowski in itself, which is by definition the symmetry group, and then the answer is Poincaré, you ask which is the set of symmetries that allow this set of metrics to become another member of the same set. So the answer will be in principle larger, because you're not asking a metric to become itself, you're asking a metric to become another member of the same set, obeying these boundary conditions. So the answer, this is the answer, is the one that BMS found and is infinite dimensional. So what you ask is, which are the diffeomorphisms that leave the metric not exactly the same, but in another metric, which obey the same boundary condition. For instance, you find that this is the null direction, if you want the null time, but it's not the time, but it's the null direction parameterized in Sky Plus. So in Sky Plus, if you ask this kind of question, which are the asymptotic symmetry group, you find out, for instance, that this is one of the Killing vectors. This is a Killing vector that is not only translation in time in this null time, could be the case in which this is constant. It's actually infinite dimensional, dimensionally larger, which is you can multiply this by any function of sit and sit bar parameterized, if you want, the two sphere that appears in each point here, okay? The two coordinates that are not depicted here. So this is a isometry, it's an asymptotic Killing vector, which is defined from an arbitrary function P. And that's the reason why this is infinite dimensional, because similar to what happens in the conformal, in the local conformal group in two dimensions, you have a function that then you can discuss whether this function is meromorphic or not. But basically, you have a function, and for an arbitrary function, you find this property. That's the reason why the group becomes infinite dimensional. Okay. So, and this has been, as I mentioned, put in a formal way by Glenn and Geoffrey Comperre and P.H. Lambert and many people. And in the last year, let's say in the last, since 2013-14, this has been used in a fantastic way by Strominger and his group, in which they use the symmetry, the presence of this infinite dimensional algebra, to uncover a remarkable relation between two seemingly disconnected topics and pretty old ones, which are memory effects, soft theorems, the Weinberg soft theorems also from the 60s, and this BMS asymptotic symmetry. So this is just in a scheme. I will not talk about that because I will talk of the horizon, but this is just to put in context what I will, this kind of mathematics I will use now, going from Sky Plus to the horizon. This is what I will do. I will go from Sky Plus to the horizon. Instead of discussing here, yes, this is a question.
Yes, this is a kind of methodological question. I mean, I think I understand the answer now with respect to the transformations you just discussed because of the connection with memory and soft photons and so forth. But in general, how do you know when you've gone too far? Going too far means that you're developing infinite dimensional symmetries of some far away little piece of the metric that doesn't actually reflect any physical phenomenon.
That's very good. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very good question. Let me answer this first, because it's an important point. So, please let me know if when I'm paraphrasing you, I'm just answering a different question. So the point is the following: you are here talking about diffeomorphisms, or if in addition to gravity you have fields, gauge field, let's say, you can do the same game talking about gauge transformation. But diffeomorphism, I'm a symmetry of the field. So why you are talking about the algebra generated by diffeomorphism? It can be interesting or not, but does it, for instance, keeps a new physics? If you make such a transformation, you are doing a diffeomorphism. What you are going to do? You are changing the physical state or something like that. It is something substantial. So the point is the following. For let me just to mention that, let me give an example. Okay. So let's consider the ADS3 CFT2 example, okay? Holography in three dimensions. So in as we know, ADS CFT tells that gravity theory in ADS in D dimensions is dual to a D-1 CFT in the boundary. Okay. And a plausibility argument for this to happen is the matching of symmetries. This, of course, is not sufficient, but it's necessary, the matching of symmetries on the two sides. And this is understood because the isometry group of ADS in D dimension matches the conformal group in D-1 dimensions. However, as Maldacena himself noticed in his paper, there is a problem for the three-dimensional bulk space because the dual CFT is a two-dimensional CFT. And then you know there that you have an infinite dimensional conformal group. And actually Maldacena, this is just a quote of his paper, asking his paper, it would be nice to understand where the infinite dimensional conformal group come from the point of view of the spacetime. But this answer had already been given 11 years ago by Brown and Enoff, because they realized that playing exactly this game, asking in the case of ADS3, which is the asymptotically ADS3 isometry, the asymptotically isometry, not the one that preserves the metric ADS3 in ADS3, but the set of asymptotically ADS3 metrics in ADS3 metrics, the algebra turns out to be infinite dimensional. And this, on top of that, they satisfy the Virasoro algebra with a certain central charge. That's the reason why we then call this paper by Brown and Enoff the precursor of ADS CFT. In that case, because we know a posteriori, that this asymptotic symmetry turns out to be something very physical because it's given the full local conformal group, the real charge of Virasoro that generates the symmetry of the dual theory. But your question is, how you know from the beginning, without having a particular example as this one, that you are not going too far? Namely, that you are just computing diffeomorphism. This is a symmetry of the theory. So what you do typically is the following. You are imposing some boundary conditions, sometimes on the horizon, sometimes in a particular surface, sometimes in the boundary of the spacetime. You impose certain boundary conditions. These boundary conditions break your diffeomorphism symmetry because you're imposing spontaneously, because you're imposing some set of boundary conditions. And then you have a remaining group. How you know which is this remaining group? The remaining group would be all the transformations that preserve this boundary condition, modulo those that are still trivial. How you distinguish which are trivial, which are not trivial, you have to compute charges. And if you have an asymptotic symmetry that changes the charges, then you consider them as physical because you have observable that you can compute. So the short answer would be, we will see that the symmetry have associated other charges. And some of this transformation, those that we consider non-trivial, change the value of the charge.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. So now let's see if we can go to the horizon and try to do the same game, okay? To play the same story. So what I will do is imposing boundary condition on the horizon. This is actually not very ad hoc boundary condition. You always can, if you have a horizon, not even more general than isolated horizon, because this function, for instance, can depend on time, on the null time on the horizon. If you have a horizon that is actually a null surface that is non-singular, it's regular, but like a horizon, then you can always set this boundary condition there. It can be easy or not to find an explicit change of coordinates to put this in this term. For instance, for Kerr black hole is very complicated, but there is always the possibility. Moncrief and Isenberg proved this, and there is a nice proof by Cruchiel. So you can always find a system of coordinates in which on the horizon, you can put the metric in this way, where rho measures the difference from the horizon. Namely, rho equals zero is where the horizon is located. Expansion in small rho, close going, means going close to the horizon. That's what these ellipses mean. They stand for higher orders in rho, next to closeness of the horizon, whatever you call it. So then sit and sit, sit bar, you want sit one and sit two, would be the angular coordinates of the horizon, okay? Or the coordinates you want to the horizon, because I'm not talking about necessarily compact horizon. This can be even more general. So sit and sit bar, or sit one and sit two would be the coordinates on the horizon. V is the null time on the horizon. So the coordinate that becomes is a time that becomes a null coordinate on the horizon. And as I mentioned before, rho is the distance from the horizon. Always you can impose this boundary condition. You can always find system of coordinates which close to the horizon. As long as this horizon is not singular, you can find this system of coordinates. Even if it's extremal horizon, a degenerate horizon, or not, you can also find this. In that case, it's kappa is zero, but who cares? This is a particular example. And then this stands, as I mentioned, next to linear order, sublinear terms in rho to some power. So then we will impose this boundary condition on the horizon, but this boundary condition means a set of metrics. For instance, this function here, what it means is this function can be an arbitrary function on the time on the horizon, an algorithm, and sit one and sit two, the angular or theta and phi, if you want, an arbitrary function. The only thing is that the first power in rho is rho to the one. It cannot be log of rho or square root of rho or nothing like that. It has to respect this expansion in rho, but the coefficients are arbitrary function of the other three variables. The same happened here. So this start from rho to the zero, and then the next two leading term will be to order rho. These are the boundary conditions that are imposed. Notice that these are different from Brown and Knopf for ADS. Of course, it's a different space, but it's also different from null infinity. Okay, null infinity, you expand on large radius. Here you are expanding in different coordinates, which is rho, is how far from the horizon you are. So these functions, as I mentioned, these are functions that are indeed arbitrary functions. And this is the reason why we hope to find something infinite dimensional here, because infinite dimension, the dimensionality, which is where is infinity, comes from the fact that you have some arbitrary function. As Lee mentioned before, this is risky because you can go too far, as he put it, and he's right, because if this function don't enter in the charges, it's just virtually, it's not really representing a physical symmetry. But if you find that at first you find the isometry, and then the nether charges associated to them, and these charges depend on this function, means that changing this function can be physical, okay? So then the first you ask is the boundary condition. The second step is, okay, now let's look for the killing vectors, more precisely the family of killing vectors, because you are imposing, you are preserving a boundary condition that are parameterized by arbitrary function. It's not a surprise that the killing vector will also be bigger than the solution of a killing equation. And indeed, when you look for which are the killing vectors that preserve this set of metrics, you find that this is the expansion you find, in which T and L are also arbitrary functions. And that's the reason why this turns out to be infinite dimensional, because you have an infinite dimensional set of killing vectors that preserve a certain prescription of boundary conditions. Okay, so this is the second step, but then there are more, which is, for instance, computation of charges that can be non-trivial. First of all, it's always non-trivial in gravity. But second of all, here we are close to the horizon. You have to be careful. You have to use a very robust method to do that. But before that, well, the question is, what do you do when you take a boundary condition that satisfies this boundary, a metric that satisfies this boundary condition, and you apply this diffeomorphism? This doesn't mean that the metric itself will be invariant, because the game you are playing here is that it will be a different metric obeying the same boundary condition, namely n can change for another n. This will not change the fact that the order, the first order is rho. That's the game you're playing. You will not allow changes that, for instance, would take the metric and put here a square root of rho in the metric you obtain after making the Killing transformation. You want a metric that will a priori change n, but preserving the same expansion. This is similar to what you do, for instance, in BMS, similar to what you do in ADS3 CFT2 with Brown and O. And this is what happened when you impose this you apply this Killing equation, you get these changes in kappa, this change in n, and this change in omega. The three free functions that appear in the set of near horizon metrics. And then what you do is, let's compute the algebra. You have these Killing vectors parameterized by arbitrary function, three arbitrary functions, L1, L2, and T. And then you can compute the algebra. You have to be very careful here, because the bracket you have to use is not the standard one. Why? Because when you make a diffeomorphism, the Killing equation can depends on the function of the metric. So you have to take into account this self-recurrence into account. So you have to modify the bracket, as Len Barnich and other people have explained. And then you have to use this modify bracket, which you can prove that is a Lie bracket, so that is satisfies Jacobi and everything of the properties you need. And then you can compute the diffeomorphism algebra, and then you find this result. This result is you can read from here that there is a Virasoro and so on and so forth, but it's not very clear. So to make it more clear, you can make a Fourier expansion of these three functions that appear: function t, the function l, and the function your l, because you have two l. And then this is the algebra you get. And as you see here from the two first lines, you get two DeWitt algebra, namely Virasoro with zero central extension. And also in a semi-direct sum, because t is actually commuting with itself, all the t's. So notice that here m and n go to all the natural numbers, all the integer numbers, because it's just the Fourier modes of this arbitrary function that parameterize all the killing vectors. And then you can compute the algebra modes, which is more easy to read. And then you get that you have two copies of Virasoro with zero central charge, namely these two DeWitt algebra, in semi-direct sum with an abelian infinite dimensional algebra with t. All the t's, which you have a generator for each value of n and m, commute with t and m, commutes with all t l q, but they do not commute with some generators of the Virasoro algebra. So you have two copies of Virasoro algebra in semi-direct sum with a super translation algebra. Yes.
Yes. So this seems to me like opposite of what you would like to find black holes interesting. Is the claim that this is universal for horizons or for black holes, that they all have the same charges with the same algebra?
Well, yes. So far, we didn't include matter fields. If you include matter fields, as I will do later, you will see that that you can get an enhancement of algebra, because you can also ask what happened with the gauge groups. And we can find even extensions that are non-abelian are very interesting. And also, another point that is important to make is that for extremal horizon, you have to be careful, and you have to make an analysis separately.
I don't care about extreme. No matter what I throw into a black hole, I won't knock it out of this class.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I mean, if you have it, yeah. Yeah, I will give you many examples. I see. And more than that, the charges are not only integral, finite, and conserved, but also carry important information. I will give you some examples of what they mean, the charges associated with symmetry.
Okay.
But the point to be made is that even though we know that close to the horizon, as long as the horizon is non-extremal, we have a kind of Rindler space, right? So I mean, it's isomorphic to Rindler, but you know, close to the horizon, you have Rindler space. This algebra is not exactly BMS. Okay, it's very similar. So if you look at BMS, you will also find infinite dimensional commuting algebra T, also two Virasoros, but the way they mix this structure constant is different. And this structure constant is very important, it's different. It's not just a rewriting, it's just a way of re-expressing BMS. It's different from BMS. You can prove that it's different from many, many, many ways. The most formal one, if you can compute the Hodgkin homology of this algebra, you will see that it has three non-trivial cycles. So it admits three central extensions, while BMS admits two. This is a proof that is very concise, but it's probably killing a mosquito with a canyon, so probably it's an easier way to prove that. But this is a proof, and indeed, this is the only one I came up with. But this is different from BMS. But another way of saying this is that the fact that this guy is not the funky m over 2 plus n that appears in BMS means that this, indeed, is like a J current, okay? Because basically, which is the structure constant of this operator, the Virasoro test, which is the weight of the field. So it's different, I mean, the spin of the field. But so then the next step is to compute the charge. You can do it in different ways. We did in the Barnich-Brand formism, we compute the charges associated with symmetry, and we find that this is the result, where kappa is the surface gravity of the horizon. These are the functions, but these functions are arbitrary. So for each killing vector you give me of this infinite family, which are parameterized by t, by l, I have a charge. So we have infinite charges, if you want. because we have infinite killing vectors, infinite symmetry, infinite chances. And then you can find also that not the killing vector algebra is only infinite dimensional, but the algebra generated by the charge then is also the same algebra. This typically happens, but sometimes it requires extra central extensions. How to do that? You have to define a new bracket, which is the bracket for the charges, not the bracket for the killing vectors. And this is done in a standard way. Okay, so this is just basically you vary one charge associated with one killing vector with respect to the other killing vector, and then you compute the algebra, and you find exactly the same infinite dimensional algebra now at the level of the charges. So in other words, this is what proves that these symmetries can be taken seriously, because making one of these transformations is changing the value of a charge. But you can say, okay, this is true if the charges you're computing are sensible. So how you know that? I mean, you probably are computing some charges and nobody cares about them. And you're right. But in that case, then the next step is to say, okay, let's see what happened with these charges, at least for some solution we know we have under control. So, and this is what we did next, is we took a kind of interesting solution, which is Kerr black hole, which an arbitrary mass and arbitrary angular momentum. This is the Kerr black hole. And then the first question we made is, okay, let's see if we evaluate these charges there, what it gives. Okay, these are charges computed at the horizon, are not BMS, are not alien charges associated to computed on the horizon. And then similar to wild charge computation, because I'm, you know, and indeed, with no surprise, when you compute these charges, the first one you found is that one of them agree with wild charge. One of them is actually giving you the entropy. Probably you remember this this paper of one of 1992, no? The entropy as another charge. You will remember there that they have Q and Q tilde, which one is different from the other one, just multiplying by kappa. This is exactly the same. One of the infinite charges we have is the wild charge. And the other ones are different charges that, as I will show, they also give physical information, but now computed from the horizon. In the case of Kerr, we don't have much to find. Indeed, when you compute another charge related to super rotation on the horizon, you find the angular momentum, but not computed from the horizon perspective. This expresses nothing but a kind of Gauss phenomenon, in the sense that you can compute the angular momentum at a la ADM, but also from the horizon perspective, we are getting also the value of the angular momentum. In the case of Kerr, probably this is not very interesting, because you have control of the geometry asymptotically as well. So why not to do it asymptotically as every normal person would do? Yes, that's true. But we'll see that in other examples are better to go to the horizon. And I will come to this in a second. Here, of course, this is J, no? Because A is angular momentum per unit of mass. So this is J. So yes, there's a question, right? No, okay. So, then, but the first with Logat Donnet, at some point we had the following question: say, okay, we are getting here at the horizon, we are getting the wild entropy and the angular momentum from the horizon point of view, which is interesting. But how we know that actually this is not a rephrasing of the computing the mass and the angular momentum through some kind of smart formula? So we should go to more elaborated solutions to be sure that actually we are getting always the entropy or something like that. So the first case, the simplest case we came up with, was looking at the Sitter space. So let's see what happened there. In the Sitter space, you don't have a horizon, you have the cosmological horizon. We go to the cosmological horizon, and then you can ask the same question. Since everything we have done there is exactly the same for the horizon, because it's also a horizon that is regular, everything's okay, we compute this, and also we get, in that case, the given Hawking entropy of the cosmological horizon. And then we were happy, but still you can argue, okay, you are doing it for Kerr black hole, you're doing it for a cosmological horizon. It's still a kind of a set of simple examples. So then we ask what more we can do. And then we check it for many, many solutions. Okay, solutions very complicated with not charges, without not charges. In that case, it's very tricky because you have Meissner strings or C. In the case of the symmetric accelerated black hole, we have a cosmic string pulling the black hole to accelerate. So we have many, many different defects to circumvent, if you want. And with Luciano Montecchio, Logat Donnet, and Sasha Brennan and other friends, we have analyzed in different horizons, and in all of them we get exactly the same result. So we are confident that actually what we are computing, even solution with many charges, when you compute at the horizon associated to supertranslation, the zero mode is always the wild entropy, and then you can compute different contributions like angular momentum, and in the case of our horizon, you can find other charges as we will see. But still, yes.
Can you go straight to the thermodynamics and rather than laying down Einstein equations, go straight to the thermodynamics and derive Einstein equations like Ted Jacobson?
Okay, yes, that's a good point. Yes, like Jacobson paper. Yeah, I don't know the answer, so I don't want to say something I'm not sure about. But there is a very nice result by Charles Marteau and Galanet, who make the contact between this symmetry and a kind of fluid dynamics on the horizon, a Carolian kind of fluid. And then I'm not saying that this is the answer to your question, but certainly this seems to be the route to look for a connection with Jacobson paper.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Robert.
Yeah, hi. Interesting. Yes. Can you go back to the checklist, please? The previous slide. So are these things that all have been studied already? Is that what you said? I missed that, if you did.
Yes. For instance, okay. The most, I give you an example. In the paper, in the same paper with Logado Ne, we wrote in 2019 on the cosmological horizons, actually, we are more general. We consider the Schwarzschild-Taumnat bolt the Sitter cosmological horizon in that paper. It includes the Sitter. I just put the kind of the Sitter for the top because it's simpler, but because the metric of Taumnat bolt the Sitter is very complicated. But yes, and I will give the example of magnetic black hole later. Yes, but there are some things that remain to check, and I will tell you which one would be interesting to do. But this will check explicitly.
Okay, thank
you. But still, thank you. And still, it can be a kind of, you could say yes, but still the solution you are considering can be involved, but there are solutions that we know analytically, and at the end of the day, the solution we know analytically are not that complicated. So still you are integrating on the horizon if you want to be Hume. Suppose you are Hume, very skeptic, okay? And you tell me, no, I will not believe you. And then what you are doing at the end of the day, you are iterating the horizon. It's not a surprise that you get the area, if you will, okay? So it's not just kind of trivial that you get the area and therefore the entropy. And it's not the case because you can ask yourself, something also we ask Willoga and Julio Oliva, is what happened if you take, for instance, higher order theory. In higher order theory, when you have higher curvature correction, let's say quadratic correction, this is the case we consider. In that case, you have corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, law formula. So the entropy is not proportional to a law anymore. So you can ask yourself how you going, if it works also in this case, and I anticipate does, which is the mechanism through which you actually gather, you really take these additional terms, these corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And the answer is very funny. This is a higher derivative theory, so it's not a surprise that the charge computation is much more involved. The expression for the charges, you can get it with the Brown-Partridge method, and it's actually much more involved. And then if you see how much involved is the expression for the charges, you realize that they enter in the expression for the charges. Subleading terms that don't enter in the case of Einstein gravity. So when you compute the charges for higher curvature corrections, the charges take into account terms that were not entering the charge before. If you do it carefully and you compute the charge associated to supertranslation now, exactly reproduce the higher order corrections to the area formula. So even in cases in which the entropy is not proportional to the area because of higher curvature corrections, the charge associated to supertranslation and the horizon gives them with the right analysis. Okay, let me consider another example. Because so far you say, okay, now you are probably convincing me that this computes the entropy and computes some charges, and who cares? You can tell me, and you are right, because why to do that if you can do it asymptotically? You want to go there to do something. Okay. And okay, we know examples in which it's better to have the control of the system at the horizon. For instance, an example I came up with, and this I solved with my student Luciano Montesquio and Sasha Brenner, is the following. We can consider a magnetized black hole. Magnetized black hole means a black hole embedded in the Melvin universe, okay? You have a Melvin universe, which is, what is a Melvin universe? It's a bundle of magnetic flux just along the space-time, okay? This solution is not asymptotically flat space. It's not asymptotically nothing, you know, nothing normal. It's not asymptotically maximally symmetric space. But okay, it will not be physical if you take into account the whole space, but it's physical to describe a region of a set of by the way, stable as well proved as stable bundle of magnetic lines. And then there you can put a black hole. Okay, you deform a little bit the magnetic lines, but this is an exact solution from by Wills and Ernst in the 70s. And this is you can put charge to it, you can put angular momentum and do different things. And then you can consider this. This asymptotically is not even Melvin. So a black hole in a Melvin universe is not even asymptotically Melvin, as Gibbon proved, because you can compute, for instance, the ergo region, which is not in a sphere anymore, and it extends to infinity. So it's even the Melvin asymptotic. So this is a solution that acquires a physical meaning very close to the center. Okay. It's a good entoy model to describe a black hole in a strongly magnetized ambient. But as long as you go very, very far, it's not physical anymore. So this is an excellent example to prove that this can be useful and not only working. Because in that case, it's better to have the computation of the charges under control on the horizon. It doesn't mean that you cannot compute the charges in a different way, like Astorino and Geoffrey Comper did it with different methods, but actually there is even a debate about the value of the charges. You can a recent one, so you can take this as a kind of intervention in this debate. And indeed we get exactly the same charges that Geoffrey Comper computed in different methods. You have to be careful when compute this, because, for instance, if you keep the periodicity of this angle, so you will find some conical defects in the poles. You have to be careful, and this is important because even though it's local, at some point you will integrate the charges on the horizon. You have to do it carefully to get the right result. And then, if you do that, you go to the horizon. You work a lot to put this in the system of coordinates we need, which, as I mentioned, it always exists, but it's not always easy to get. And then if you do it, and you manage to do it explicitly, you can compute the charges and you get this result. Here, I put the results only for the non-rotating black hole. So you have a black hole with mass and charge in a magnetic universe, but you can put rotation if you want. But they put it without rotation for interesting reason, which is the charge associated to rotation, to super rotation, is non-zero, even if the black hole doesn't rotate. You would say that this is weird, but it's actually what you expect. Because at the end of the day, what you're computing is a charged black hole in the ambient of a magnetic field. And the pointing density, the angular momentum associated to the field is actually zero and it's given by that. So this is the right result for the angular momentum. If you compute the angular momentum for this Geoffrey method, for instance, you will find exactly the same result for the angular momentum. So what we are looking at, see here, is that super rotation charge gathers even the contribution to the angular momentum of the solution given by the electromagnetic field that extends far from the horizon. And you are computing it exactly. Again, you are getting this Gauss phenomena, but gathering all the contribution to angular momentum that extends from the electromagnetic field. Okay, and then you can check that all these charges agree with the one that Geoffrey Astorino and Roberto Olivieri computed for these solutions. Then the next step will be, okay, it works for a solution now. You convince me that probably for some solutions it makes sense to go to the horizon because asymptotically something that is not known. And then let's see we can make a deeper question. What kind of process can produce this kind of diffeomorphism, this kind of change in the horizon? Okay, you are now talking about changes on the horizon that even though they are diffeomorphism, are large diffeomorphisms that change the charges. which kind of process, dynamical process or physical process would change, would make this such a perturbation? And then the first analysis, this is not an example we did, this is an analysis that is an old example by Kip Thorne, Price, and McDonald. You can find this in papers, but also in the book of the membrane paradigm. This is one of examples in the book, which is this start, this small start. This is not the probe approximation. This is a approximation in which the mass of the star is small in comparison to the mass of the black hole, but is non-zero. So actually there is a parameter here, which basically is the ratio between the mass of this star and the mass of the black hole. We'll call it epsilon. And then you can consider what happens if I have a star close to the horizon and put it to the horizon, okay? In the next two leading probe approximation, not in the probe approximation, one step more. Then you will see at some point the star will disappear from the horizon. And basically you will get again a black hole alone, no star anymore. Okay, you will get this. If you do the computation as Thorne, Price and McDonald did, you get this. This is in the book they wrote. This is the solution you get for the horizon once you put the star into it. But you know from Virchow's theorem that this has to be symmetric, isomorphic to the Schwarzschild black hole, because at the end of the day, now you only have a black hole. So, and indeed, you can find a change of coordinate that indeed it put it back in the form it was. This is a two-dimensional constant slice metric on the horizon. But precisely, you know that the active change of coordinate you have to do to remove this perturbation is actually superrotation, okay? So this was just, for them, was just a proof that Virchow's theorem was okay in a very non-trivial case. However, Robert Pena put this in a modern context, noticing that exactly this is the kind of process that you can see that actually is creating a superrotation at the horizon. But still, solving this example, I mean, Bob Pena did it very nicely in the paper, but with Logadone, Andrea Pum, and Hernan Gonzalez, we try something different. We said, let's consider something different. Let's consider a transient gravitational wave that goes from infinity and hits the horizon. Why we do that? Because we want to make contact with the paper that Perry, Strominger, and Hawking wrote, not the first paper they wrote about the information loss paradox, another paper they wrote later, which is in which they precisely consider a super translated version of the Schwarzschild black hole. But super translated means that for them, going to the sky minus to asymptotically null infinity and make a BMS super translation there, not super translation on the horizon, a standard BMS super translation apply to the geometry of the Schwarzschild black hole, okay? Just super translate the Schwarzschild black hole. This is what they did. If, according to them, making a super translation is indeed something physical, so this solution has to be in the sense that it changed the BMS charges. So this is solution you get when you super translate the black hole. Indeed, if you put F, it will F parameterize the function, which is an arbitrary function of the angular coordinates that parameterizes the supertranslation you're performing. If you put F equals zero here, you will recover the Schwarzschild black hole in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. But for arbitrary F, this is an arbitrarily supertranslated Schwarzschild black hole from infinity. What we did is just say, okay, then this is, if you want, you can think of this as a wave function profile that propagates all through the boundary, and then it hits the horizon. So the question we made is that if you have the Hawking, Strominger, Perry supertranslated black hole, and this gravitational wave profile hits the horizon, what? Because this is if you see, actually F has a Heaviside theta function here, so it's like a pulse at some point, makes a bump. It propagates to the horizon, and then basically what you get in the horizon, you can see, is this perturbed metric. And if you see in our language what it means, corresponds to turn on the horizon, both supertranslation and a superrotation. What it means is that if you prepare a package of a wave function to go from the boundary, from the sky minus to the horizon, which the data is given by a super translation function f. It's a super translation transformation. On when it arrives to the horizon, it mixes between it turns on a super rotation as well. Okay, yes, Celine.
Yeah. So that won't change the position of the horizon. Actually, the this burst.
You can see you can no it doesn't. I mean okay. you can see in the paper the expression of the.
So that you send some energy, I mean, you send something that will just change the air, but will keep the horizon. So it doesn't change the zero mode, I guess.
It changed the function. It changed the function that parameterized the old air with the parameters of the black hole.
Okay.
In a way that F enters there, but it's not changing the mass of the black hole because it's just described by a different morphism.
Okay.
But it changed the BMS charge on the horizon. You can compute the charge on the horizon and have changed. We did this example because we wanted to say, okay, Hawking was claiming that near the horizon, you should find super translation. And we look for this explicitly. We found super translation and super rotations. So we wanted to see whether super rotation were not only there, but also were necessary there. And what we found is that they have to be there because when you want to translate to the horizon, what you are doing when you super translate only at infinity, you turn on a super rotation as well. That's not the reason why. And then we say, okay, let's see what happened in more general cases. And indeed, with Luciano Montesquieu, we extended what we did with Loga, Hernán, and Andrea Pum, because in that case, we also consider a gauge group, but you want to the end. With Luciano Montesquieu, recently what we wanted to do is to consider color black holes, namely black holes in the Einstein-Young-Mills theory. And then what we did in that case, of course, now we have more involved theory, and then even finding explicit solution for this, you know, that is very complicated. You know, in America, you can do that, and also you can do it in higher dimensions, like Tausen and Gibbons did. But in general, finding a color black hole solution or young gravitating young monopole solution is very complicated. But then you can find this Young-Mills theory coupled to Einstein theory for an arbitrary compact gauge group. And then you do all the, but now you have to prescribe also boundary conditions to the horizon associated to the gauge field, not only for the gravity field. And then you can compute the algebra. And probably with no surprise for the experts because Glenbarnich and P.H. Lambert found it asymptotically like BMS at the horizon, more precisely the loop algebra associated to a non-abelian gauge group. So what we see here, answering the first question, is that the horizon also have, as before, two copies of Virasoro in a semi-direct sum with a super translation symmetry, but now also mixing a non-trivial way, also in semi-direct sum, you also have a non-abelian infinite dimensional algebra, which is a Kac-Moody algebra, or more precisely, loop algebra, level zero Kac-Moody algebra. And then this is interesting because it proves that the same phenomena than Glenbarnich and P.H. Lambert found at null infinity, namely the fact that for Einstein-Young-Mills, you not only find BMS, but BMS in semi-direct sum with the Kac-Moody algebra, we find exactly the same on the horizon. And the horizon, we don't have BMS times the Kac-Moody algebra, but we have our horizon symmetry, which is different from BMS because of its structure constant, in a semi-direct sum with Kac-Moody algebra associated to the gauge group you are considering. So this is a huge algebra if you consider. But let me mention something about extremal horizon. Extremal horizon have to be considered separately. And the reason is because even though everything I said is correct, valid there, the kappa is zero in that case. So when there are many leading terms that you have to go to a sub-leading term, then the computation, if you want, ramify a little. You can do this, and then you find a different algebra. The algebra you find is actually two copies of Virasoro and two super translations, but only one of these super translations is physical. The other one is, as Liz Molin said before, going too far. You can see that one of these super translations is fictitious in the sense that it doesn't enter in the algebra. But then you can compute the charges there. And there is something that Logan and Hernán made me notice. I did notice that for them it was a kind of trigger for me now, that in the case of a extremal black hole, you have two symmetries, a Virasoro and a super translation. But if you find a subsector of them, namely you link them in an interesting way, you make a reduction of this, you get exactly BMS algebra. This is BMS algebra. It's not look like BMS algebra. This is exactly BMS algebra. But when you compute the charges in that case, only the two Virasoros survive. The only one gets purgation, okay? This is different from what Céline and collaborators did, that is prescribing a different set of boundary conditions, which includes ours and other cases. There is a parameters there that just go to a more a larger family of boundary conditions. In that case, they can get BMS algebra, exactly BMS algebra, or our algebra from the horizon perspective. But here in our boundary condition, you can also get as an algebra of diffeomorphism for extrema black hole, exactly BMS algebra as well, but not for the charges, okay? So this is what I had to say. And okay, it's the first time in my life that I finish on time and talk. So let me summarize a little bit and then we can open for questions. So the first one is that close to the horizon, the black holes exhibit these infinite dimensional symmetries, which these symmetries correspond to the asymptotic isometry group that preserve a sensible set of boundary conditions. I say a sensible set because finding a set of boundary conditions is, as Andy says, it's an art, because you have a compromise between having boundary conditions relaxed enough to have infinite dimensional algebra, but not too relaxed to have finite charges. So it is actually difficult to find them. In that case, fortunately, it's not ad hoc boundary conditions. Are those that Moncrief and Eisenberg told us that always you can impose on a horizon, which is non-singular. So the symmetries have neither charges to them. I didn't explain why the title of my talk had the restriction of being isolated horizon. Because here you can do it for marginal horizon, and so far I have done this. But when you compute the charges, for the charges to be functionally iterable, the horizon have to be isolated horizons. And the reason, well, there are many reasons why we can extend this later discussion. The reason why integrability is related, I didn't want to talk about integrability because it's a technical part of the talk. But this, our second paper, is more about integrability of the charges. The integrability of the charges are related to isolated horizons condition, basically, because for not isolated horizons, you have a time-dependent induced metric and the constant time slices of the horizon. And then when you put in the charges, it gives a non-integrable monster. So, but for isolated horizon, they are always integrable. So these charges that are integrable are also finite. And actually they obey an algebra that is infinite dimensional. And these charges carry physical information about the black hole. The Wald entropy is an example, but also superrotation contribution in the case of, for instance, a black hole in the Melvin universe gives the contribution of all the angular momentum associated to electromagnetic field. And also, if you put rotation to the black hole, spin of the black hole. And also, if you consider, for instance, something we did with Logar and Hernan and Andrea Pumo as well, was considering, for instance, a magnetically charged black hole, and you can compute the magnetic charge of the black hole, or even the tau charge of the black hole. And so this can be realized for charge and spinning tau nut bolt ADS or DS black holes. With acceleration, I didn't talk about the symmetric, but also you can do it for symmetric with Luciano Montesquieu, we did it, and in the presence of external magnetic fields in Einstein-Yang theory. And I would add also taking into account higher curvature corrections as Julio Oliva proved. So this is what I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gaston, for the very nice talk.
Thank you.
Are there questions? So I see one by Robert.
Yeah, hi. So what happens to this? Or maybe ask it a different way. Can you understand this in the context of gravitational collapse? So I would assume, like, this seems to need horizons, right? So prior to collapse, this symmetry isn't there. Would that be correct? And then all of a sudden it is there once the horizon forms?
Yes, right? Yeah. That's a good point. Yes, indeed, actually the reason why I took a first look at this plunging star example of a membrane paradigm. Then Robert Pena did it before me and better. So that's why I stopped. But the motivation I had is because it's a toy model to understand not the collapse of an entire black hole, but something going through. So as a first approximation to answer this kind of question you're posing, which is very relevant one from physical perspective. The one you're asking is more involved because you're talking about not something that is collapsing to the black hole, but you know the black hole collapsing as a whole, then the horizon appearing. And then with Hernán try to generalize this and Yoga to evolving horizons. But the evolving horizons are much more complicated. We just took a look at the problem. We didn't insist too much because it was very complicated because they are non-null.
What about the Vaija solution? That would seem to be the simplest one, right?
You mean like a shell collapse into a black hole. We did. I mean, a kind of that is the one we did with this example of the way of the memory effect in the sense of this wave going from the boundary to the horizon. In that case, you can see that, for instance, if this Vaija solution, this is actually the computation of Hawking, Strominger, and Perry. What they did is just make a super translation at the boundary of the BMS super translation of a Schwarzschild black hole, that they look like a Vaija solution. You see the super translation because actually it's a shell that is actually collapsing into a black hole. And then we just went through the boundary and asked what happens to perturb the horizon. And we just found that it turns on some super rotation charges there. But I didn't consider more this problem in more detail, but that's a good question to make. So I don't know the answer for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be interesting to try and understand that better, don't you?
Yeah, yes, actually, because it's a dynamical process in which you see the perturbation working there. But we only did this example I mentioned.
Okay, thanks.
A last very dumb question. If you can code an infinite amount of information in these infinite number of considered charges on the black hole horizon, then why do physical black holes only carry finite information?
Sorry, you mean?
If I come upon a black hole, and I'm free to tune the values of an infinite number of charges, then I would need more information than the Bagenstein Hawking bound lets me have.
I have to be honest here. I'm a skeptic about the application of this to any kind of solution of information or counting of information of the black hole. What it is true is that this can tell something about the thermodynamic of the black hole. As we saw, one of the charges is the entropy, and it's actually computed with the right parameter, and it comes very clean without nothing to tune. But about counting, in a strict sense, counting information, I don't know, actually, because I don't have any good argument against or in favor of that. I mean, all the arguments against that, also, I find it a little bit rapid. So I don't know actually. I have thought a lot about that, but to be honest, I'm very confused about this. I think it's very interesting to explore this. Certainly, it's very interesting to explore the relation with the information of each charge. It's very interesting. I find very very interesting recent extensions, like for instance, Berlinde and Pastersky did this relation with the firewall thing and super translation. There are many things I'm very confused about. But certainly I can say is that what is formally, I mean, mathematically true is that these charges are there, are finite, integral, and something they compute, you know, physically for relevant quantities, but how to use them to, for instance, explore information problems on this thing, I'm really confused. Each time I want to think of that, I get confused.
Great, well, so do I. So thanks very much, it's a great talk.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay, so let me ask a couple of questions. It seems to me that your starting point was a manifold that is asymptotically flat. But so do you have any insight on what would happen in the case of asymptotically sitter space-times?
Yes. Indeed. we started with, I mean, in our paper we did for Kerr-Macross and asymptotic flat spacetimes. I mean, part of the analysis is kinematic, which is the analysis of the symmetry, and part of the analysis is dynamical, like the ones of the charges, when you need what particular theory you are talking about. And in that case is where it matters whether you have or not a cosmological constant or matter fields. Or whatever. And at the beginning, we did for asymptotic flat spacetimes, but with Logar in one of our papers, in the one we discussed the cosmological horizon, we consider the case in which you have tau not charges and also asymptotics that can be the sitter or the sitter, and it works as well. It's interesting because you can have solutions with different horizons, you know, like a black hole in the sitter, for instance, there's something. And we also consider the Narai limit and many examples, and it always works. But you can do it also for asymptotic ADS or DS, which is interesting. Once with Leopoldo, Pando, Sayas, and Logar, we try to see whether other subtopics are related. For instance, in the case of asymptotic ADS, natural question is what happened with ADS CFT. In the case of extremal close to the horizon, what happened with Kerr CFT. And okay, there are things that matches, things are different. It's also an interplay between all these descriptions. Should be, in my opinion, some general framework that gathers all this together, but it's complicated to understand. But for instance, let me say something about the change of asymptotics. A more basic question is what happened when growing, forget about black holes, we're going from ADS to BMS story. Just take the cosmological constant and take the limit to zero. In the three-dimensional case, you can do it because it's a Wigner contraction. But in the four-dimensional case, this gave rise to this amazing story of the lambda deformed BMS, and it proved how complicated it was. So I don't know. I think it's interesting to look for a framework in which all these scenarios fit together. But okay.
Okay, so
that,
in a sense,
sorry, short answer to your question, it also worked for ADS. And
yes, I would have imagined that. But so in a sense, if you take the sitter onto the sitter and you take the cosmological constant and send it to zero, then you would have, in a sense, this continuous limit because the symmetries and the algebra are very different in that cases, or?
Yeah, no. If you, in the asymptotic scene, if you look at the asymptotic in the boundary, that's very non-trivial case. And you have to go to a lambda BMS and see how it connects the leaking boundary condition in ADS with the standard BMS. This is highly non-trivial. From the horizon perspective, basically you are in a black hole. Basically, you don't care what happens in the asymptotic. That's the funny part. I mean, this is the reason why it's interesting. But if you, for instance, but you have to be careful because there are examples which are special. For instance, the Narai limit. You take the black hole. You can do it in the sitter horizon. And when you take the limit, also you have to be careful about this limit because it's a degenerate horizon. So you have to make the analysis separately. It works for the Narai also. But you know, you have to be careful. It's not sometimes when you went from one, there are some, if you want some discontinuity, you have to be careful. It works in general.
Okay, thanks. Are there questions? More questions? Let me ask one more question. Then, at some point, you were discussing the case of where you modify the action and the higher derivatives, saying that you would have modifications to the black hole entropy from the
yes.
World formula, but you would still see a sort of area law from the computation of the charge. And I wanted to ask you whether this result is independent of the number of derivatives that you put in your action.
Well, we did for a quadratic correction, so you have four derivatives in the equation of motion. Namely, you have to be careful because you will also have this problem when you compute the charges. When you make the Noether theorem, you have to be careful about these terms. And it's not the only thing you have to be careful about. It's how to define the variational principle. Because if you have a higher derivative theory, you have to tell me what you are going to impose on the boundary. So first of all, you have to come up with a natural, well-posed boundary problem. Once you do that, you make the Barnich brand analysis or the Hamiltonian analysis, and you get the charges. And everything works nicely. but we did it for further derivatives. So quadratic corrections. No, we didn't do it for, you know, you can get, for instance, you know, for instance, in six dimensions, you can get interesting conformal invariant corrections with, you know, Weyl, box Weyl or something like that, mm-hmm. or things like that. We didn't do it for that because, I mean, you had to really have a problem to be in a pandemic situation and compute Weyl, box Weyl, you know, you mm-hmm. kill yourself, but you can do it. I mean, we did it only for further derivative. You want a short answer?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Actually, if related to that question, if I can ask, so you check the charges, your modifications, but do you check the algebra? Because I wouldn't expect the algebra to get modified by higher derivatives.
You expect the algebra to be modified by higher
derivatives? I do not expect the algebra.
The algebra, I mean, at least the example we consider, because when you go to higher derivatives, you have to be, you know, you cannot do it in general because you need a black hole solution to do that if you want to do it analytically. So in the examples we case, we have exactly the same algebra. Typically what you happen when you have, even in IDSCFT, for instance, three dimensions, mm-hmm. when you get the higher derivatives, what changes in the algebra is the value of the central charge. This changes, but doesn't change the algebra. But sometimes it happens the following, it can be tricky. And this is something we follow. It's the following. Suppose you have a higher derivative theory, not an arbitrary one, but some of them allows to a relaxed falling off. Typical example is the conformal gravity. Conformal gravity is a higher derivative theory that allows for a mode, as Malacena discussed, that goes down softer than the one in Einstein gravity. And it happens many, many, many cases. For instance, in the so-called chiral point of topological massive gravity, also you have these log terms that goes like weaker version of Brownian boundary conditions. When you have that, since you have more normalized modes because something goes down, like you can trigger a new generator in the boundary. Namely, you can get an extension of the algebra. Your intuition is correct. You will have the same algebra as before, but plus something sometimes for the theories that allows for weaker boundary conditions. In that case, it can happen in some particular points of the space, of the parameter space of higher derivative couplings. But in general, as you say, you will get the same answer, okay?
Yeah, yeah. If you change the boundary conditions, for sure you get a different algebra.
Yeah, but exactly. But otherwise, it's exactly the same algebra, except mm-hmm. when you have a central extension, the value of the central charge can change. But oh yeah, as an algebra, it's.
So otherwise, can you see the effect of the higher derivative, for instance, in memory effects for the horizon? At the horizon?
Well, the value of the charges, since the expression for the charges will change, when you make a perturbation, the value of the charges will change. Because now the charge, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. the charge will depend on next two leading terms in the near horizon expansion. But the value of the charges, but otherwise I don't see any difference you will see. But the value of the charge itself will change.
So the action on the shear at the horizon, let's say, would be modified by the higher derivative?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't have a good reason to say no. Mm. The value of the charges can change, but I don't know. The entropy changes, so the angular momentum changes as well.
Mm-hmm. Because sure.
But I don't know.
Okay, so maybe we have time for one last question or comment. But I don't see any. So there have been many questions already also during the talk. So I would suggest now that everyone unmutes themselves to thank Gaston for a very nice talk and discussion.